Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without good old Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very excited to talk to Ben Marcus, the author of The Flame Alphabet. It's published by Knopf. Ben, now tell me, this book seemed to me to be a very frightening book and willing to be repellent. In it, language itself, particularly the language spoken by children to their parents. And maybe it is true right now that the young speak a language that parents cannot understand, or maybe better still, that the young speak a language that novelists and readers can't understand, but somehow the young don't want what we want. And what they have to say pains and frightens us. And in this book, that pain and that fright is real, is physical, is a disease. The older people are diseased because of the language the younger people speak. Tell me a little about that. Where does that come from?
It's an amplification of something I think is already true. And I wouldn't even just say that the young speak a language that we find frightening, but that we all do. And as the book develops, it is really not just the language of children that is the culprit, but all language. And somebody in the book, a villain, says, what made us ever think we could consume as much of this as we wanted to? And I became attracted to the idea that we produced this thing, language, and we use it indiscriminately all the time. And sometimes, I think, fail to account for what it really does to us. I think also within a family, language seems to be triple strength. That, or with any loved one or enemy, that once your relationship develops and deepens, somehow language is charged so that with a few words you can fell someone. And it's interesting to ask what we really need to say to each other. If we had to strip it down, what is the most important thing to do with language? It's a tool. As I stripped language away from the characters in this novel so that they couldn't speak to each other without becoming sick, I had a chance to wonder about what people are without it. We've had a lot of romantic fantasies throughout history about the self without language. The person who crawls from the woods raised by wolves is the subject of great speculation. We're sort of in love with the idea of what we might be without language. And then in mysticism as well, language is almost the enemy. Language is completely inadequate to touch a real spiritual experience. It's almost mocked. It's seen as an inefficient tool. So all of these things were swirling around for me with this book.
Now, these ideas take their shape within a novel that I guess used to be called a medical thriller. Last time I looked, it was...
Is it not anymore?
It was... Well, I don't know. Because when I knew it was attached to a book by, I think, Robin Cook called Coma, and I think that was when I was 16 years old.
I remember that movie.
and now we have a movie like Contagion. But it's a novel in which this inability to speak without causing fevers and vomiting. And we're watching a whole culture reassemble itself. I can't tell, because the reader in this book is seen as finding his or her way. Certain similarities, it's almost like the Nazis were not defeated, and now something like World War II is continuing in upstate New York, where a theorist, social biological theorist, is saying that this disease has come from the mouths of Jewish children.
Sure.
What's the circumstance? What's the tense of the book?
Well, when people become sick from language, there is, in the scientific community, in the novel, denial and finger-pointing, and medical as well. I was interested in what would happen with an affliction like this if science threw up its hands. Then it makes sense to look to religion, to wonder about the irrational. If the empirical method fails, if rational method fails, if in fact they might even be the culprits, then religious insight might get ourselves out of this. And so in the book, there is a villain character who is quite covetous of what to him is the last repository of knowledge to which he doesn't have access. I like this idea too, because it's easy now to feel that if we want any kind of knowledge, we can simply get it. That there isn't some sort of elusive or exclusive or hidden knowledge, in sort of in the Kabbalistic sense, something that's being deliberately kept from us. And so I wanted this to motivate the villain. He felt he'd exhausted the tenets of science. Science wasn't working. Was it possible that the forest Jews in the book were keepers of some kind of solution because of the cautions against language throughout Jewish mysticism? Was it possible they had some wisdom that might help? So he wants to flush out these secretive Jews in the woods by accusing them of starting this problem. It's scapegoating.
Now, to jump into the thick of things, we're reading a novel composed, of course, in language, in which a world without language is being posited and, at least initially, shaped. So the thrilling thing that happens in a modern novel is that it has to be set against itself. You wouldn't be able to read this novel if it were giving you the headaches and convulsions that language is said to breed. Was that part of the fun of composing it?
I worried about this problem so much I almost didn't write the book, because it struck me as a kind of insurmountable irony or conflict that you can't use language to write about the end of language. But on the other hand, that was also why I wrote the book, because it felt at its very core to be an impossible task. It just didn't seem that you could do it. And of course, some happy reviewers have pointed out that that's just sort of too much of a contradiction. On the other hand, there's a moment late in the book when the narrator says, he actually addresses the reader, something I really hadn't thought I would ever allow myself to do. And he says, I picture you somewhere reading this, and I don't know how you've managed to. I don't know how you've, what sort of medicine or cure you've taken, what serum you've pursued that allows you to read language without getting sick. And he says, I remember those times too. You know, enjoy yourself. But there's a sort of assumption that you can only read this if you've overcome this problem. I wanted him to sort of assume he's actually creating this for the future, if there is a future.
We're talking to Ben Marcus about his new novel, The Flame Alphabet. So, in other words, the narrator of this book, Sam, is writing for a better world, a world in which these problems ideally have healed themselves, if only, a world beyond the world he lives in. But language is what we think makes us individuals. And so as we read the book, Sam seems to turn into his enemy, Murphy, who turns in turn into the, what I think of as the evil Dr. Lebov.
Yeah.
And we come to understand sort of that in this way of thinking, any user of language becomes any other user of language. Something like that?
Sure. Sam takes up residence at this research lab in Rochester called Forsyth, where it's his job, he feels, because no one can actually tell him what his job is, to try to create a new language, to go back to the beginning, cuneiform, hieroglyphics, linear, Coptic A, and to refashion these alphabets, these languages, and test them on people. And one by one, they fail. And he, without language... At one point, he realizes that one of the benefits of the language toxicity is he doesn't have to explain himself. And I found myself attracted to what does happen with morality when accountability sort of becomes squeezed smaller without language. It's very difficult to figure out where morality comes in and how it's mapped. And he has a phase that is a bit darker, and I think it came out of his despair, his sense that there wasn't much really to live for, and so even human interaction at Forsyth, the sort of recreational sex that they have is mechanical, and you know, it's, you could think that you could have, well, a fairly complete sexual transaction with someone without language, but in their hands, it's quite animalistic and strange and possibly not even gratifying. And so his morality does start to shift a little bit, but then I think it's possible that he rebounds.
Many things in this novel start to become suggestive of other things. And so the getting of wisdom as opposed to knowledge, they seem to suck it out from the ground through cables or pipes.
Just like we do.
In what sense?
you don't do it that way?
No, I
haven't tried that.
But you know, like pulling maple syrup out of the tree.
Well, there's a radio in this hut, in their synagogue, and the radio is connected to underground cabling. And it, without... For the radio to work, it needs this thing called a listener, which is a flesh-like but inscrutable appendage that has to be wrapped around the radio. And so they have a hard time getting religious information from this apparatus.
They yearn for it.
Yeah.
They're hungry for it. They remember a time when it was better before it started being on what seems like a feedback loop.
Yeah.
They seem to know a time when a rabbi gave original testimony of interpretation, and they wish it were back. Now, for some reason, Ben, this yearning has been with you since your first book, The Age of Wire and String, where there's been some original state of completeness that now has to be reconstituted or rebuilt by using wire and string, by reconstructing families, by reinventing God. What's the impulse here?
I wish I could tell you, but it is one, and it returns, and it is always, I think, driving me in some way. In the Flame Alphabet, I became very interested in the idea that religious wisdom should not be that easy to acquire. We go and sit in a church or a synagogue and listen, and there's not really an impediment necessarily to that. But as I read and researched a little bit about Kabbalah, you learn about how there was one guy who kept some pretty important information, and no one really knew who he was. And in fact, his wife ran interference. And then you'd learn, after you found her, that he had died a long time ago, but may have whispered something to this other guy. And I'm fascinated by that level of secrecy and the desire and hunger it creates, if you feel inadequate with what you've already heard and what you've already learned, if it feels inadequate, if it fails to speak to your own idea of what the world is or might be, then what do you do to get that deeper information? So I found that at every turn in this book, the religious transaction itself was extraordinarily difficult. Why do I do this? It's a hard question, but I just couldn't have them going to synagogue and listening to some strange sermon. It seemed that it was too easy and too flat.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Ben Marcus, and we're, well, what's the best word? Worming our way into his new book, The Flame Alphabet. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Ben Marcus about The Flame Alphabet, published by Knopf. It's a novel that takes us to the very extremes of societal dysfunction, when communications not only break down, but language itself becomes lethal. Now, tell me, are these literary beliefs, mystical, spiritual beliefs? Are you inventing your own internal social system in which a new religion has to be invented, and this is being siphoned out from the psyche of Ben Marcus, who is imagining a future to which, to whom, these revelations and this dark history become relevant?
Well, I think new religions should be invented. It's odd to think that our religious curiosity would be fully satisfied given the difference within the species, the difference we have emotionally, spiritually, intellectually. The idea that religious curiosity has been satisfied and will be is odd to me. And I feel that I, even back to my first book, always wanted to create a religion, to build one, because I think of religions as needing the properties of a novel. They need to be compelling. They need to be believable. Not all novels, right? But many of them. They need to project authority and in some sense chase after or acknowledge our deepest, hardest questions. But I hadn't figured out how to do that without it seeming simply like a static conceptual project. So in this book, when the chance came up, it seemed very linked to really the plot of the book. And it also seemed very linked to Judaism, which I think is in some sense the most, to me, adaptive religion. It has a history of subversiveness, at least culturally. There are so many cautions against language, a kind of a feeling that language is inadequate, but a feeling that, well, in Kabbalah, understanding itself is actually to be mistrusted. If you feel yourself understanding God, then, well, you are certainly wrong. Understanding is a sign that you're on the wrong track. So this at some point made me think, I'm not really even making this up. This is not made up. This is just simply hidden away. And well, I'm going to use it now because it's there. It's true. And so that was how this arose. And that's why it's called Judaism. And that's why I didn't just make up a name for this religion.
Well, in this book, the things that men are doing to run away from the troops that are pursuing them, to isolate them or isolate the children who are speaking infectious language. The detailings of these pursuits is history. The return to the hut where you suck out from the earth a transmission that seems to come from a rabbi who acts as a transactor between God and man. That spirit, and there seems to be nothing in between. What is fiction here? They're given broadcasts of Aesop's fables.
Well, the children use Aesop's fables broadcast through loudspeakers to repel the adults. Once I realized that the children could use language as a weapon, the vocal weapon in the book, I gave them loudspeakers because then they could project their weapon further. It's what you do. If you have a weapon, you want your weapon to be stronger. But then I thought they could just sort of project gibberish from these loudspeakers, but wouldn't it be interesting if these sweet, beautiful tales that we love so much would be used against us in some violent way? I think throughout the book, I was attracted to the idea that, for me anyway, this thing I love the most, that I can't imagine my life without language, would be in more and more crazy ways used against us, used to undo us. So that's how Aesop's fables came to be used violently.
And so in the book, it's come to be thought that it's not language necessarily that's dangerous. It's either meaning or meaninglessness.
Yeah.
And they're bordering each other that become dangerous. Now, can I ask you, though, do you have a child?
I have two. I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old. Yeah.
Is it worth speculating about the fear of language in the mouths of children as a biographical impulse for this book?
Sure, but I love my kids and they're sweet and their voices don't do this to me. I
thank goodness.
I worry. I know it is. That's a luxury, I suppose. I do work through reversal, and I was thinking at the very beginning of the book, I thought a lot about what a first sentence of a novel should be. What is it supposed to do? What is the imperative, for me anyway? And in some sense, I was drawn to writing something that was so impossible and almost unbearable that I would have to write the next sentence to justify it, to illustrate it, to sustain it. And that is the first line, we left on a school day so our daughter wouldn't see us. And that idea of leaving a child willingly seemed unbearable, impossible to think through. The conditions would seem to be so severe and hard to imagine that counted as a viable first sentence to me because it speaks so much against my own experience. I felt that that would be territory that I could work to discover. If there's autobiographical material, it would be purely emotional. I'm not so good yet at literalizing something from my life. I don't seem to be able to make it interesting to anyone else.
This is fascinating to me because one of the things that I felt about the book was that it was interested in being repellent, repulsive, and that not in an easy way, not in the way that a swaggering bully would want to say things that were so offensive that you'd be offended, ranked out, hurt, and annoyed, but rather that the book wanted to say that if language in our own time, whenever this book takes place, but if language in our own time is harmful to us, and it seems to be in our political interactions, in what we hear on radios, in what religions are making of their original transmissions, this book somehow needed to find a way to get beyond these repellent aspects into something purer.
I think really, at the time, while writing this, I felt that page by page, the problem had to grow for me to stay interested at the dramatic level, for me to find a way to continue for it to even be an interesting book. So what was it for the problem to grow? How do you escalate something like this? And I was very aware of trying, and I'm not really sure why, to make things worse. And not worse in some kind of graphic or violent way, but worse in an emotional way. That seemed to me to be my very crude idea of what you do when you write a novel if you want it to feel dramatic. And I think there are writers who are wonderfully capable of generating this drama while people are just sitting and having tea. But I found I couldn't really accomplish that without this situation, the epidemic, that needed escalation. It needed escalation. I have trouble staying interested in some things I write, and I simply stop. And I find that if the story or the sentences are troubling enough, I want to return to them. And it might just be that for now, I wanted to write a very, very bad dream. I wanted it to feel that way because bad dreams are fascinating to me. When I wake up from them, it's so compelling, so gripping, so biologically altering. You feel that, you know, you've been saved from a terrible fate when you wake up. And I think in some sense, I couldn't inhabit a book that didn't have that sort of adrenaline.
I've been talking with Ben Marcus, author most recently of The Flame Alphabet, published by Knopf. Thank you, Ben, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Flame Alphabet at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz, but today we're recording at NPR West, and our recording engineer is Leo Del Aguila. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we just read this, read that, read this, read this, read that, read this, read that, read this, read that, read this, read that. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm. She is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we just read this, read that, read this, read this, read that, read this,
read this, read that, read this, read that.
I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.